And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Dave Cushing. It's a brave new world as medical technologies provide more cost-effective genomic sequencing, gene expression analysis, and a myriad of lab results. Medical imaging products have become more sophisticated every year, and new pharma therapies are introduced every week. The good news is that we're all living in this renaissance of medical science discovery. The challenge is, how do we understand, communicate, and manage all of this data to ultimately make the best decisions? Our first guest this morning is Don Brown, who's the founder and chief executive officer of Lifeomic. Lifeomic is a software company that leverages the cloud, machine learning, and mobile devices to power precision health solutions for providers, researchers, and healthcare IT, pharma, and individuals. Don Brown, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Great to have you here. Tell us about your company and the solutions that you provide to clinicians, researchers, employers, individuals.
Well, we're about a 65-person company headquartered in Indianapolis with development offices here in the Salt Lake City area, as well as Research Triangle Park. And we've built a cloud platform on top of Amazon Web Services that allows us to work with clinical teams and aggregate all this big data that you mentioned that's being generated, everything from whole genome sequences, the sequences we were born with, to the separate sequences, if God forbid we develop cancers, and all the stuff from our electronic medical records and other traditional sources.
Okay. And I also noticed on your website that you don't call it precision medicine that you tailor to individuals, but precision health. There's a distinction, isn't there?
There is. There's a really important one. And I think one unfortunate aspect of the healthcare debate that has been ignored is, how do we keep people healthy and avoid the need for expensive treatments in the first place? Everything's focused on how do we pay for all this expensive stuff, and that's important. But I think it's at least as important to consider how we keep people healthy longer. Yeah.
Don, what do you consider yourself, a hardware company, a software company, a service company, all of the above, and how do your customers interact with you?
Well, we're definitely a software company.
Oh yeah.
So we don't have hardware. We're fortunate to be able to kind of delegate that to Amazon Web Services. You know, they have these huge data centers around the world, and companies like ours can pay by the drink for right. What we use. So we're able to kind of pass those savings on to the organizations we work with that are, by and large, academic medical institutions that are trying to just aggregate all this data for their patients so they can figure out how to best treat them.
Could you tell our listeners about a specific application of data from a customer situation?
Yeah, our biggest collaborator has been my alma mater, the Indiana University School of Medicine. And they have three disease teams focused on triple negative breast cancer, pediatric sarcomas in kids, and multiple myeloma, which is kind of a leukemia that hits older people. And so each one of those has about 1,000 patients, and for each one, they're loading all their electronic medical records, the sequence of their tumors, what's called germline sequence, what those patients were born with, and then trying to build machine learning models to predict who will respond well to a given therapy.
I first learned of your company from Annika Burns, a friend of mine, who very enthusiastically told me about what you all were doing. And I had not heard of intermittent fasting before. And she told me about the app, up to 400,000 users. I've downloaded the app. I've now become sort of a student of fasting, because all this was new to me. Can you talk about your first introduction to fasting and what it means to you personally and your family, and how you've been able to bring that out within your company?
Yeah, you know, I got an MD years ago, but about 4 years or so ago, I really wanted to catch up on all the exciting developments that have taken place in the life sciences since I got my degree. So I went back through a program, a graduate program in biotechnology at Johns Hopkins, and stumbled onto this notion of temporary nutritional deprivation, you know, which is a fancy way of saying, you know, no calories for some period of time. There had been a discovery that I'd heard of back in the 90s where they essentially starved organisms or put them on a permanently restricted diet and were stunned to find that all the way on up the evolutionary ladder, from worms to mice to chimps to humans, that reducing calories caused those organisms to live longer and suffer less disease as they aged. There's even a society of people who live permanently on about 1,200 calories a day. I saw a documentary about them. The thing was, they didn't look like very happy people. You know, they really couldn't enjoy beer, pizza, the things that most of us do. And I quickly dismissed it as something that, you know, for most people, certainly for me, would not be a sustainable approach. But then I came across a paper by a guy at USC, a prof there named Walter Longo. And he and others have demonstrated very convincingly that you don't have to live with that sort of permanent calorie restriction, but rather you can just starve yourself for a few hours, a few times a week, and kind of activate an ancient survival program that kicks our cells into a recycling mode that clears out a lot of the gunk, the misfolded proteins that are associated with really severe diseases like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's.
Oh, that's fascinating. And I saw a documentary as well, which really surprised me. Back in the 40s and the 50s, the Russians, there was a Russian doctor who had a patient who was ill and did not want to eat any food. Sort of instinctively, his body told him he should not be eating food. So he said, yeah, go ahead. You know, usually a doctor would say, no, you have to eat. So the person went without food and over time got better. And he was intrigued with this and started a study. And the study grew to many hundreds of people that actually started proving the benefits of fasting in all the different iterations. And the government looked at it and said, well, I'm not sure about that, but we're going to check the data out anyway. And then it became sort of a staple of Russian healthcare that they were encouraging all of their population to do this periodically.
Yeah, the health benefits are indisputable. There are medical clinics in Germany, well-respected places, that specialize in medical fasting. So they bring patients in, and under controlled circumstances, they fast them for long periods. There's one well-documented case of a doctor fasting a patient for a year. So, you know, we walk around with so much stored energy that most of us could very easily get by for long periods of time without eating anything.
Well, you're bread and butter, you were telling us, in the green room is from institutional customers, but yet you've developed an app for people to track their own nutrition and other things based on you and your kids experimenting with this intermittent fasting. Now 400,000 or so people have downloaded this, and you do have this blog on your website, which is about individual health. So you have quite an interest in that, too, it sounds like.
Yeah, I do. I think these really converge. At least we're hoping they do. We see a future where eventually there's a cloud platform where clinical team trying to help you can access your information, but where you can also access your own information and monitor your own health. There's a big movement called the quantified self of people who want to measure their own sorts of indicators and try to kind of follow along, even assist the healthcare providers, and not just delegate their health to a doctor they see for 15 minutes once a year.
That's interesting. And some of your blog articles are about lifestyle management things like nutrition, and I like this one, how to break the wheel of weight loss and regain, which looks like you wrote.
Yep.
And in reading it, I was learning about the leptin cycle.
Yep.
Is that worth talking about for 45 seconds or so?
It all ties together. And we were talking earlier, and the way I characterize it is that our society is dying of overnutrition. You know, this is for the first time in our existence as a species, we have nutrition available to us around the clock. And we're just not built for that. And it really ends up being very deleterious to our health. Probably the simplest way to understand it is that, you know, insulin is this signaling molecule that flows around in our bodies and overall is telling all our cells whether or not there's energy available. You know, so insulin, when insulin is knocking at the door, it means times are good, there's plenty of nutrition around, you know, open the door, let the glucose in, don't worry about cleaning up or recycling or anything, because we're living high on the hog right now. But when insulin levels drop, it's the opposite signal to the cells. It's like, holy crap, you know, maybe we killed an antelope and now we're going to be starving for the next 5 days as our band, you know, walks around a forest or a desert to find additional food. And that message tells our cells it's time to get serious. It's time to start recycling, building new components. Because we don't know how long we're going to be in this condition. And, you know, unfortunately, our society doesn't activate that very beneficial program.
Right, and keeps the insulin flowing through lots of nutrition, and especially some of the things that Americans and others tend to eat, right?
Yeah, and so what happens, but with leptin, it's another signaling molecule that actually comes from the fat cells. It's called a satiety molecule. It's telling our brains, look, there's plenty of energy here. We shouldn't be hungry. You know, tell the stomach not to be hungry right now because, you know, we've got tons of fat already stored here. Unfortunately, we push that cycle so much that it kind of breaks down, and the brain can become resistant to the leptin signal. It's like the boy who called wolf. You know, after a while, you know, people stopped listening to the boy. The brain stops listening to the leptin signal when it gets too high. And so you end up with this paradoxical situation where people can be obese, but they're starving. You know, their brain is telling them, it's not hearing this leptin signal anymore. So it's saying, hey, I'm not hearing that there's energy out there, so go eat. And obviously that's tremendously damaging to our health.
How do people find your blog as part of your website? What's the address?
Well, right from the app. There's a little button that you can access a whole wealth of materials. But our if you search for lifeapps.io, that's where our website is. That has we have a network of science bloggers, actually from around the world, who contribute those articles.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Don Brown. He's the founder and chief executive officer of LifeOmic. LifeOmic is a software company that leverages the cloud, machine learning, and mobile devices to power precision health solutions for providers, researchers, healthcare, IT, pharma, and individuals. I moderated a panel a couple of years ago on undiagnosed illnesses, and I was surprised to find out that there are so many people that are suffering with illnesses, and they don't know what's wrong. And it's not from lack of trying, because they and their families have been seeing one specialist after another. So a couple of questions. How big is the undiagnosed illness family of people? And what sort of things can AI and LifeOmic do for them?
Well, I think that community is huge. You know, we've learned a lot in the life sciences, but we are complex instruments, right? You know, we're comprised of 30 trillion cells, you know, complex organ systems. There's a lot to go wrong. And so on some level, it's not that surprising that things would break down in such a way that doctors wouldn't be able to clearly identify what's going on. Now, part of the solution certainly is data. You know, the more information you have, whether it's a car, an airplane, or a human body, you know, the better you're going to be at diagnosing faults, you know, trying to figure out what's wrong. But I think an equally important thing is doing what we can as individuals just to keep our bodies in good running order. And you know, I know all of us have heard lots of contradictory evidence over the years. You know, eggs are good, eggs are bad, butter's good, butter's bad. But there are things that the scientific community is pretty much settled on. And there's stuff our grandparents could have told us. Maximize intake of fruits and vegetables. Get lots of plants in your body. Move. Just try to burn some calories every day. Take some steps to reduce the stress in your life through breathing or meditation or walking in the woods or whatever it is. Get sleep. You know, we're realizing how important sleep is. And then the timing of when you eat is important. Traditionally, we've evolved as a species to eat during the day. And then we would crawl into a cave or something. We were more worried about being eaten at night than opening a bag of cookies, right? We didn't have those available. And that kind of downtime is built into our bodies, the need for that sort of downtime from calories. And so that's the biggest thing people can do is after dinner, try to have dinner relatively early. Don't do it Spanish style at midnight or something. But after dinner, then wait until breakfast. If you can, delay breakfast a little bit and give your body 12 to 16 hours or so of a break from calories as often as you can. And we had initial success with this app focused on intermittent fasting called the Life Fasting Tracker for both iOS and Android. But now we're developing a second-generation version that encompasses these additional sorts of health elements, ties into our cloud platform so individuals can load their genetic information, their electronic medical records, and have a system in the cloud that is giving them personalized recommendations.
Okay. We had had a program on a few months ago, maybe it's a little bit longer than that, where an organization built an AI model that could identify marks on a person's body, similar to what a dermatologist would do. Is it suspicious? Is it not suspicious?
Yep.
And they showed it 100,000 photos, this system. And then they took a bunch of dermatologists that had 5 and 6 years' experiences, and they had a little competition. The dermatologists were able to ascertain 87% of the time correctly, and the machine, working 24/7 without lunch breaks, could do it 92 or 93%. I understand that you have something similar that you've put up in the cloud, an AI system that individuals can interact with.
Yeah, and that's our vision for where all this is going. We want people to be able to upload photos, a photo of a questionable spot on the skin, a photo of your face from year to year. And we're finding that simple pieces of data, like a voice recording, there are researchers who are able to diagnose Parkinson's probably 20 years before people show clinical symptoms because they can detect micro tremors in their voices. And so there are all sorts of examples like this where as long as we can come up with the data, we can feed it into a machine learning model and start to predict who's going to develop different things years in advance.
So could I upload marks, say, on my face and have your machine look at it?
Soon. Very soon.
Okay.
Yes.
It's the era of big data and all the privacy concerns that go along with that. So how do you manage privacy concerns for individual users, but also data breaches and all that good stuff?
Yeah, it has to be baked in from the beginning. As a software team, when you build a platform, you have to encrypt everything. You have to take a number of steps. Fortunately, in healthcare, there are a couple of standards that we're forced to adhere to. One is HIPAA, and so that imposes a number of privacy constraints. We went a little bit further. There's a security standard called HITRUST that is kind of difficult to get, and we went through that certification process. And the other big piece that the Europeans have been pushing through something called GDPR right. is essentially the right to be forgotten. That if you give us your data and you decide a week from now, you know, I don't like those guys anymore, I don't want them to have my data, by law, you've got to have a very simple way, and we provide it through our app, where you can say, delete my account, delete everything you know about me. And so it's that combination of securing, encrypting what we have, but then making it easy for patients to opt out at any time.
400,000 downloads so far, and it's free. Do you intend to monetize the consumer aspect of your business at some point?
I mean, the short answer is yes.
Yeah, right.
We've got to pay these software developers. Our intention is to always keep the free app, certainly the free intermittent fasting app, with the second generation app that is a more general purpose health and wellness solution. We'll offer some subscription plans so that we can provide very personalized services to people above and beyond what they get in the free version.
And at what point would you consider a public offering, if you haven't already? I assume you haven't.
I know. I'm funding the company myself. Right. My last two companies have been public, so
right.
I'm pretty familiar with the process. It's enough of a burden that you don't want to do it until you need the money that
right.
you can raise from a public offering. So we're pretty happy with where we are right now, and who knows a couple years down the road. But right now we're fine with financing from within.
Don, when will people take more control of their healthcare by cutting out some of the traditional gatekeepers that collect and analyze samples, as an example?
Well, they're doing it today. There's a huge what's called direct-to-consumer movement that the FDA has fought. One of the big battles was with the genetic testing service 23andMe. 23andMe incurred the wrath of the FDA by disclosing, say, the status of a woman's BRCA genes, you know, for risk of breast cancer. So the FDA kind of fought the whole effort for a while, but I think they've largely backed off. And now there are all sorts of genetic and other tests that you can have run from the comfort of your home. Somebody, if you want to track your thyroid or your testosterone level or your cholesterol, somebody will actually come to your home and draw blood, and you get the results back, and you do with them what you want. There are more and more measuring devices for blood pressure, EKG, and so that's what we're trying to tap into, this what's called quantified self movement of people who don't want to just leave their healthcare to their physician or hospital. They want to be monitoring their health day to day and taking steps to deal with any problems, you know, before they become severe.
And what kind of diagnostic information can we get today by just doing a simple pinprick and then analyzing it, rather than bring somebody in to draw your blood?
Yeah. Oh, the biggest things are your sugar levels, glucose and ketones. Those are very easy, and there's reliable consumer tests that will let you, as you say, just prick your finger and see what your glucose level is when you get up in the morning to get a feel for, you know, where you are on the diabetic spectrum. But there's more and more coming. Unfortunately, the more sophisticated tests require an actual blood draw.
Okay. And it seems that AI has been slow to move into healthcare. I mean, it's certainly in there now, but if you look at other industries, but it's starting to happen, isn't it?
It is. The problem with healthcare, the crazy problem, is that we don't own our data. You know, when we go and have a blood test at a hospital or, some imaging study, they own the data and they make it very difficult for us to get it. And so it's because data is all over the place in the healthcare system that it becomes of very little use in terms of AI, because AI thrives on data. You know, the reason Google is so powerful is because they have access to all that data, and healthcare just hasn't gotten its act together to consolidate that data into one place and one form where it could be leveraged for AI and machine learning.
Don Brown is a Park City resident. I believe you spend some time also. You have a home in Indianapolis.
Yes.
As well. And he's the founder and chief executive officer of LifeOmic. We want to thank you for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We shall return.